Bitcoin is like a little taste of truth. It's a little bitter because you've been lied to the entire time, but it's very satisfying. A lot of atheist Bitcoiners with kids homeschool their kids.
Why would the atheist side of that be the weird part?
Well, because homeschooling is known to be a very Christian thing. The phenomenon that I've seen a lot of Bitcoiners start taking Christ seriously. And every time I tell my Christian friends this, they're always surprised. When people get into Bitcoin, they turn to Christ. They're like, you go where the evidence leads you. There's definitely an aspect of that I think that causes a lot of Bitcoiners to come to Christ is that idea that there is an objective truth. Very well might be things that the conventional narrative misses.
Welcome back to the Adam O'Brien Show, where we are on a mission to inspire the next generation by pursuing objective truth. You know it's out there, and so do I. We're trying to find it. Today, we're talking to Jimmy Song, another legend in the space. We talk mostly about morality of money, lots of Jesus, talk about his upbringing and kind of how he started making the path towards Jesus and Bitcoin. So another one you don't want to miss, another one that I filmed while I was in Fort Worth. It was an absolute blast. So don't miss it. Stick around and check out Jimmy Song. Your family immigrated to Canada from Korea. Is that right?
Just my parents immigrated from Korea to the US when I was 8 years old.
And you were eight. And so they obviously brought you with. So you grew up in the
New
States.
Jersey. Yeah.
In New Jersey. Okay, yeah. Sweet. And
Jersey boy.
While you're growing up, are you... like today, you're author, programmer, Bitcoiner, you know, all the good stuff. Is this always how you've been, or was this a drastic shift at some point?
I've been a programmer since I was like 9.
Okay. So you moved to New Jersey and you just like got to find some code. So
I still remember, we're recording, by the way.
Yeah, we're in.
Yeah, yeah. So I still remember the first day I went into the classroom, right? I didn't know any English,
Oh, you're English second language?
Oh, totally. I mean, well, I was 8 years old, right? I could tell you stories about like tasting my first banana and things like that. But I still remember going into the classroom and it was third grade, right? This is like 1985. And I went into the classroom and I saw this machine in the back of the classroom.
Whoa.
Right? And it was, I think it was a PET machine, right? It's like an old school computer.
Okay.
That it didn't even have like a disk drive. It had like cassette tapes. You inserted
like the big ones, like 8-track.
No. Okay. It was like a normal cassette.
Okay.
You inserted it and it read it somehow, and then it loaded the program, and you can like play it on the thing. And almost instantly, I was like, okay, I need to play with this thing.
And had you seen a computer? Like, do they have them in Korea at that point?
No. So that was my first exposure to a computer. Cool. Was what is this thing?
Yeah.
And I was like extremely fascinated by it. And because I didn't know English and the teacher didn't know what to do with me, I said,
go to the corner.
Yeah,
with
go to the back and do some like rounding exercises. And I didn't even know what she was saying, really.
Wow.
But I would figure it out just by like, oh, okay, it's if it's greater than 5, you just do one more and, you know, one less if whatever.
So it was like accounting.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, like estimating or rounding, right? Like
yeah.
Those like dead simple stuff. But I started with that, and that was, and then I started begging my dad for a computer pretty much from that point. And I think the next year he got me the Commodore 16.
Commodore
16, not the 64.
Okay.
The 64 was the one with the great games.
Okay. So you got the non-game version.
Yeah. So, and the Commodore 4 was the one that was on all the commercials on TV.
Commodore 4.
The 4.
Okay.
But Toys R Us only had the Commodore 16.
Wow.
So I got the Commodore 16, which literally came with one game. And it was a cartridge, which was like very strange for a computer. But from a technical perspective, I guess it makes sense because, you know, you don't have to load it or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like you do with a cassette tape.
It would just read off of the cartridge.
Yeah, straight from the, you know, the metal contacts or whatever. But it had one game. It was called Jack Attack, which not coincidentally was the same one for the Commodore 4. But like there were maybe two other compatible games with it. And it And they were both text-based games. And of course, not being proficient in English, it didn't make any sense. It's like you are in a room, right? It's like the old like Zork style games, right?
Yeah.
What do you want to do? And I'm like, I don't even know what I could type, right? And I tried playing those games. It was like too difficult not knowing too much English. And even if you did know English at like a third grade level, I think those games are difficult enough. Like you wouldn't know cognitively what to even ask the computer to do, right? So I ended up playing Jak Attack a lot. But the other thing that you could do was it had line basic. And this is like 10, you know, print this, 20, go to 10, right? And it would like get in an infinite loop or whatever. It didn't have functions or anything, but it was enough that I started playing with it. And I convinced my parents to like send me to like a 5-day computer thing during spring break, stuff like that.
I'm not gonna lie, man. That sounds terrible. It's like,
but I, this is what I wanted to do. And, sure. And you know, eventually my mom found like, some, I guess, woman that had her PhD in computer or something or other. I don't even know where she found this woman.
Wow.
But like I still remember she was like really pregnant. And she,
this girl, like this lady?
This lady that had like a PhD in something computers, right? Like
and computers, it sounds like are pretty,
like back in the DOS days where, you know, it was like all command line or whatever. Like Microsoft Windows was like barely a thing.
Yeah.
Right? It was like at 2.0 or something. It's like the late 80s. And I still remember like going to lessons, you know, every like Tuesday and Thursday or whatever.
Computer lessons.
This lady, like it was just me and my sister. We were the only students for this lady. And I don't even know how my mom found her, but I've asked her since. She's like, I don't remember. And there's this pregnant lady like teaching us how to actually do stuff. Like, she taught me about variables. I'm like, what? You could have variables?
Okay.
What? You don't have to like statically like print stuff
every single time.
Yeah, you could, and you can actually ask for input from the user.
Right.
Okay. Wow. This is like mind blowing.
And you're at this point, you're like 10 or 11 kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was sixth grade or something.
Okay.
Like that.
Yeah. Right in the good formative years.
Yeah. So I'm learning all this stuff, and I still remember. I think her dad or somebody was like working in the background, like trying to network computers, like in the DOS days, which now looking back, that was clearly what he was doing, but yeah. I didn't recognize it at the time. It was just like, you know, very like cutting edge stuff at that time. But that's how I learned, and I was like obsessed. And you know, eventually in high school, I took some classes, and I've been doing that like most of my life, right? Like,
so you're kind of on bleeding edge of tech in like the 12, 13, hitting computers and stuff.
Yeah. High school, it was like Windows was a thing, and you know, you could like go program. And I never owned a Mac because they were too expensive.
Right.
but like, you know, my dad kept getting me like nicer and nicer computers, like, you know, the original 8086, I think.
I know nothing about old computers. This is like blowing my mind.
8086. This is like the precursor to the the 286, 386, 486.
So, okay.
Those are like the Intel processors and stuff. But I had one of the original ones. I still remember the monitor was monochrome, right?
Okay.
And it cost like a good deal of money.
Yeah.
My dad paid like $2,000 for it.
For a monochrome monitor.
Computer.
Right?
And I think it was manufactured by Hyundai, if I'm not mistaken.
So if that's actually, so $2,000 for that. Uh-huh. A computer today is about, I just bought my family the cheapest MacBook Neo. Uh-huh. It was like $800.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that plus the inflation, these computers are basically free today compared to what they were.
It came with, I think, 1 megabyte of RAM. Right, like that's how old it was.
I remember my first iPod.
Hard drive was 30 megabytes, and that was considered
30 megabytes.
That was considered like a lot. And
you got 128 gigs in the camera here.
But 30 megabyte hard drive, and like games were on like the 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and that was revolutionary.
Wow!
Right, because And I remember if they had like two versions of it, like it was 356 kilobytes of data, but you could flip it and you can record on the other side for another one. Or they had like a more dense one that could take like a whole megabyte. That was like, oh, you could have a whole megabyte on a 5 1/4 inch.
And what were you storing? Like, what kind of stuff is going?
Well, so you had games and stuff, right? Okay, so and then they had like all this copy protection stuff to make it like difficult. And then they had like all these programs that would figure out like the boot sectors and stuff like that and copy all those. So you copy games from your friends and like, you know, play it. And I had my cheap ass like monochrome monitor. So it was like a great experience, but it was great because I could play these games, right?
Yeah.
And you know, like boxing games and golf games. And my dad really liked the golf game. But, you know, this was like the thing, like this was early PC gaming. And at least back then, like the big thing was like the Sierra games, right? This was King's Quest, Police Quest, Space Quest.
I feel like I've lived under a rock. I know nothing of this.
Well, this like the late 80s, early 90s of stuff. And like anyone that's kind of around my age, right? Like I guess Gen X or whatever, late Gen X, like these were for computer geeks of that era, these were the games.
Right.
And you would play them and, you know, they had like a text interface, at least early on, where you had to like type what to do. But it was also graphical because you can see the character.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
And I mean, a lot of these you can like actually go play on JavaScript on some website somewhere because like they, you know, they have like a nice emulator for it or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, that those were the things, right? Like that was what you would do with those computers. And
so where does that turn into, or did it ever, like you ran down, you find Bitcoin very early. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in the cypherpunk circles or were you less cypherpunk and more programmer?
So cypherpunks like were, I was a little too young for that, right?
Okay,
so
okay.
The cypherpunk mailing list was like 92. And that was when I was in high school. I was too young for that.
Right.
Whereas like somebody like Adam Back, you know, he was like in grad school or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, it made sense. Julian Assange,
yeah.
You know, people of that generation, you know, got to participate in that. Mark Andreessen, obviously. But I was a little too young for that. And I like there was no you have to remember this is like pre-internet. Right.
Right.
Like,
yeah, totally.
For me, like I still remember like doing network stuff, like just I like having my first modem. Right.
Wow.
Like that was like a huge thing. Like, and this is like almost like pre AOL almost. Right. Like
okay.
where you could like go log into somebody's like bulletin board system and you tie up like your home family, like the family phone line.
Yeah.
Right. While it's going. Gee, gee.
I remember this. Yeah.
Whatever.
Get off the internet.
and you know, you'd log into it and like you'd sort of be interacting, but not really with other people. And like, I didn't have like an email address or anything until I got to college. And, you know, it was a very different era.
Totally.
Where you would like interact with your computer and like the like networking aspect really wasn't there until at least for me, like when I got to college. And now you could like email people. It's like, oh my God, you can like, you don't have to write them handwritten letters, right? Like, now, you, at least early on, you send these like long letters to your friends. Like, I don't know if you had like camp friends or whatever.
Yeah. But
you'd
and
like
pals, basically.
Yeah. And you'd like actually sit there
take an hour like and write it out.
Yeah. Write out like a 2-page letter and then like send it through the mail. And then you get something back maybe like 2-3 weeks later and be like, oh, this is awesome. I could. And then you get to email and you think, this is how all communication is going to be. Now you don't have to send 2-page letters. You could just type it out.
Yeah, and they get it instantly.
Yeah. And then like, you know, at least with my high school friends, we would write these letters back and forth. And, you know, it was like this wonderful technology. And of course, now we don't do that anymore.
No.
Like your emails are like, no, yeah. Did you get this thing or whatever?
Yeah, it's like one line.
Yeah, like I still remember. I would sit in, like, sit on my like the dorm computers or whatever, right? Like, and write emails for like 2 hours.
Wow.
Right. Like.
Wow.
And like, there were all these people I was keeping in touch with. And, like, I think at a at like sort of a subtle level that improved my writing like significantly.
Well, probably, email, yeah.
Right? Because like,
2 hours. I mean, if you're spending 2 hours doing anything, you're just actually going to get better at it.
And I would do this like every day because, like, at least early internet, like, just that was what you did, and you didn't have spam, right? Like it was like my university, you know, email account, and there was like, and you try to keep in touch with whoever you could and whatever, and you know, some of the correspondence like would fall off or whatever, but it was like. It was more like letter writing,
yeah,
and rather than sort of the transactional nature of email now, which you know, I kind of miss those days, honestly.
100%.
It's very, very different.
Yeah. It seems a lot simpler too.
Yeah,
I think now all I, you know, I can't be bothered to text anymore. Right. I just voice note and basically voice noting a robot to do some kind of task.
Yeah, we text message or whatever.
For sure.
Which, but like, I used to have to actually like think a lot about like, well, okay, what am I going to write this person about? And you know, you used to like, at least when you used to handwrite, it's like, okay, what's the next sentence going to be? Because you don't want to cross out.
No,
like,
for sure.
So yeah, and that translated over. So it was a. Yeah, it was definitely like a very strange era to be growing up in because, you know, like a lot of people that got into email earlier than that, like they had a very different experience, and people that got in later, they had a very different experience. And the reality of spam wasn't really a thing until, I guess, more the late 90s and stuff like that.
The chain letters.
Yeah, the chain letters. Which
forward this to 10 friends or you'll get good luck or something like that.
And you know, like it was a very new thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, whereas nowadays, like with social media and stuff, you're constantly seeing like other people or whatever. Back then it was like kind of special to get like email from like your friends.
Right.
And even if they're like just across campus or whatever, it was just like, oh yeah, yeah. It wasn't like making appointment. Hey, let's go meet up at 7 o'clock and at this place to have dinner.
It was conversation.
It was like, hey, you know, what do you think about this? Or you know, like my friend, like a lot of my male friends, we just be talking about like Michigan football or something.
Right.
And it would be like two paragraphs on it, or ranting about like the last week, like we lost or because of this or whatever, and. It was such a different era, and I do wonder if it'll ever come back, because in a sense, like, we've lost that, and the only people that do write like walls of text are like arguing on the internet instead of like you know, like, deeper communication that I felt like was more indicative of that, like maybe mid to late 90s era.
Well, this era too marks a time before we're all addicted to our screens. Like now everyone's trying to get rid of the screen and you know, stop the email, get in touch with real life, because but at this point it's novel, it sounds like. It's not something you can do with just anybody, and getting like, I wake up on an average day with between 100 and 150 new emails in my inbox from like from when I went to bed at like, you know, 11 to when I woke up at 6. There's like 150 new things to look at and stuff, and it's like, I hate getting emails. Like, if you want to get a hold of me, email's the worst way to possibly do that. And even my phone number is like become a disaster with it being leaked and stuff. And it's, and you know, obviously Twitter DMs are insane. And like, there is no good way to get a hold of someone at any point at this point. You know, I don't answer the phone if we don't have an appointment. And like, it's just like, it's insane. And it's crazy how, you know, hearing your story from kind of early there. Yeah. And then thinking about my kids, like you said, you got a kid going to college. My oldest is 9, and we homeschool them, and I'm teaching them to vibe code and you know, like get in touch with, you know, the AI tools that exist today. And even as I'm doing this, I'm like, this is kind of dumb because they're going to be way different in a year, let alone in 10 when you actually need to use these things. And it's, the tech game is so interesting watching
it's always changing, right? Like you're mentioning you had like 150 emails like yesterday, right? Like I would be so happy when I would see like three new in my inbox,
because
that would mean like three really like,
good conversations,
you know, responses, and like you get to write them back. And you know, I was always like sort of looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And, but you know, nowadays it's like 150 emails. Probably 100 of them are spam.
Yeah.
40 of them are, you just need to respond to something. Okay, let's meet or something.
Yeah.
Or, And maybe another 10 is like, you know, okay, I need to go meaningful. Do something before I yeah. respond. Like very, very few that are actually like people connecting with you at sort of that writing level. Mm. But this is, that's a little bit of the human experience that we've lost because yeah. of sort of that attention economy, yeah. you know. I mean, do you remember like in the early 2000s, like,
vaguely.
Yeah. It used to be that people would just constantly refresh their email, right? Like, cause there was no social media.
Yeah.
Right. And,
yeah.
and you'd be waiting for somebody like, and if you had like if you're a single person and you had like a, you know, interest in somebody and they, right. you're like, those emails were like how you flirted or whatever. and like, you know, you'd hear about like people just like clicking refresh, hoping that right. like
for a
know,
new one.
Yeah. But you know, that sort of instinct has been completely subsumed by, you know, social media where yeah. you're constantly getting this feed of that.
The and, infinite scroll.
Yeah. And you're constantly getting the attention towards those things. And it's never really satisfied. I do sort of miss that era.
Where yeah, totally.
That, like where you were anticipating something and you were actually excited about something rather than, you know, this constant scroll of like, we're almost getting too much.
Yeah. yeah. And so then where in this journey do your mm-hmm. Christian libertarian mm-hmm. kind of beliefs start forming? And yeah, and, yeah cause that's it, coming from Korea. I don't know what the religion is in South Korea in 1985, but I can't imagine it's like, is it Christian at this point? Are you guys coming over as Christians or where does this happen?
Yeah, my grandmother is a devout Christian.
Okay.
And she actually made all her children send her grandchildren to church and stuff. So
okay.
at that point it was like,
so she's dictating to your dad or your mom?
My mom.
To get to church with you and your siblings.
Yeah, and that's how I got my first exposure to church was like when I was 5 years old, my mom walked me over. It was so in Korea, there are all these like large apartments with like 50 units or whatever.
Right.
And that's at least at the time, like how, where everyone lived. And there was like a neighborhood church. So she walked me to there one day with, on a Sunday and, said, "Hey, can you find your way back?" Yeah. I was like, yeah. Okay. Then
when you were fine.
Go to church. I mean, but this is how safe it was, right? Like it. And this was with my sister who's younger than me. So it was like the two of us.
Wow.
To church at 5 years old. And because she didn't want to go, right? Like
your mom.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, the thing about like immigrating, I think, which was really good for my parents is that when you're an immigrant and, you know, obviously they don't speak English that well either. Mm-hmm. So they wanted Korean friends and church was where you went to go sure. find them. So yeah. they started going to church almost right away when we,
okay.
when we moved to the States and they were at that church for something like 25 years.
Right? Okay.
So they were there quite a long time.
And was the libertarian angle always a piece of that?
No. So the libertarian angle came later, I think.
And would you, I guess, I kind of, like, uh-huh. would you describe yourself as a Christian libertarian? Is that
yeah,
how you,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The libertarian angle, I think, came after I started working.
Okay.
I think, you know, I think it's a normal thing for a lot of people that start working right after college to like get shocked at how much of your income gets taken away in right. taxes.
And what's the saying? If you're a conservative before you're 30, you don't have a heart. And uh-huh. if you are a liberal after you're 30, you don't have a brain. Is that the saying? Something like yeah. that.
So I think it definitely changed my perspective significantly as I started working and as I started getting paid more, like as a coder and like seeing how much of it went to the government and yeah. stuff like that. And the really radicalizing thing for me was 2008
right.
was, you know, that was just like, where did this money come from?
Mm.
And that's, I think when I really became a libertarian and, you know, that
did
also
you ever-
happens to be when Bitcoin was born, right?
Right. Did yeah. you have an understanding at this point? So at 08, mm-hmm. they're obviously printing piles of money to give mm-hmm. to the bankers who sucked at their jobs. And are you understanding that that's hyperinflation and like Austrian economic principles and all these kinds of like pretty hardcore?
Yeah. Know, so I ended up reading End the Fed by Ron Paul
cool.
In 2008.
At that time, was that book like that book's kind of demonized by a big mm-hmm. group of people right now. Was that the same way or at that point was it pretty neutral writing?
I think it was still kind of fringe, just Ron Paul. Yeah. I mean, the Tea Party, I think, made it a little bit more mainstream, but then it got like taken over and stuff like that. Yeah. But that was like for me, like a big like eye opener on all of that and understanding how it works. And I got much more libertarian in that regard. But then, you know, I was still working in tech and, you know, doing startups and things like that. And it really wasn't until I encountered Bitcoin in 2011 that I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like
there is a fix.
yeah. Like this is the, and I don't know if I necessarily connected it to libertarianism until a couple of years later. Cause
Bitcoin, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Cause, like, early on, like you literally had nobody to talk to about with, right? 2011, you know, I was working at a startup with like two co-founders and I was telling them about it and they're like, oh, that's interesting. Shut up, please.
Right? Yeah.
Like,
get back to work. We have stuff to do.
Yeah, and I worked in a co-working space with a lot of other startups. Like nobody, I told multiple people, hey, like there's this new currency thing. It's like, well, how are you going to set up payments for your app or whatever? And I was like, oh, well, we should look into this Bitcoin thing. And all these other people were and these are startup people. These are technical people.
Put on the bleeding edge of tech.
None of them were interested in it. And so I had to kind of like keep it to myself and I'd be like going on the Bitcoin talk forums.
On the IRC chats.
none of that I didn't get into later, but like, Even that little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And this is about like the most you would think conducive to it. For at that time, it was that unpopular, right? Like it was that fringe that I had zero people to talk to in 2011, and it wasn't until 2013 after I had moved to Austin, and I was I was working on some stuff and, I was trying to post on Facebook and literally like, no, I posted when Bitcoin was $80.
Yeah.
In 2013, like, please people go look into this. Right? I sent my parents like video, there was like a YouTube video explaining Bitcoin and somebody had translated it into various languages. I sent them the Korean one and they were like, I don't understand this. Like, what is this? I was like just begging people to look into it. And I had like two takers out of my entire like Facebook, you know, like group.
Wow.
That was interested. And they ended up making an email list. I think
you're back to email list. You love it.
Yeah. Or like listserv or whatever. Right? Like everyone would reply.
The reply all.
Yeah. And it was literally like five people. And that was my first instance of like a Bitcoin community.
Come on.
Right. It was in April, March and April of 2013. And I still keep in touch with a lot of them today. Right. Yeah. But that was my first exposure. And it was just like, and you were begging for some news, right?
Totally.
Like just because like there's just nothing in the mainstream, nothing.
Yeah.
And we'd be talking back and forth. Like, okay, yeah, like there's this one exchange and it's Mt. Gox, right? Yeah. And that's the only one.
The Russian payment rails that you had to go through to get there.
And there was one guy that was sort of like the veteran of the group. It wasn't even me, right? Like it was this other guy. Still keep in touch with him actually. But he had been in it since like 2011 and knew like wasn't all those IRC chats and all that stuff. He knew about like MPEX and Mircea Popescu and all that stuff.
He got like taken out.
Yeah. Well,
it looks that way from my perspective.
Probably. But but literally he was like our OG back then.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he would tell us that, and he's the guy that told me that summer, like, get your money out of Mt. Gox. Like this.
Oh, he knew.
He was like, something sketchy is going on. Okay. Just get your money out.
Wow.
Self-custody. He's like, go download Armory Wallet or whatever.
Yeah.
And I downloaded Armory Wallet. Thought it was all crappy.
Yeah.
Ironic because I ended up working for them as VP. but that was what, you know, that was the state of things. So like it was like totally the Wild West back then.
100%.
Like just like nobody knew what the hell was going on. And like the Austrian economics angle was like nascent at that time. Very few people knew.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like October of that year that I went to my first Bitcoin meetup in Austin.
Oh, cool.
And that's when like the economics angle started solidifying. And I was fortunate enough to become friends with Safe through some of those people. And he was like, I have this book manuscript. Does anyone want to like sort of give me some comments on it? And I started reading it, couldn't stop.
Yeah.
And I swear I marked up that Word document like crazy. I gave him, I don't know, like 200, 300 comments on it. And he was very appreciative.
Yeah.
And
that, Safe's a good guy. He's such a genuine, when he asks you for something, he actually means it.
And that book, of course, ended up being the Bitcoin Standard. And that for me was like the crystallizing moment of everything just sort of coming together. Okay. Now this is the argument. So yeah, it's funny because when a lot of people are like, oh, you were just lucky, or you got in early or whatever. It's like, you don't understand just how lonely it was, how crazy it was, how little resources you had. Yep. Like if you got one Bitcoin article a week in the mainstream, that was a good week.
Oh, one a month. So when you got in like March 2013 at $80, this is kind of when I remember hearing about Bitcoin. I bought it at $100 and then, you know, saw the great collapse from, because Mt. Gox collapsed in December of that year and brought it from like 1,000 down to whatever it was, $200-$300 later in 2014. And I remember just being like, that was a crazy ride. Like this is nuts. And I remember sitting with one of my friends in Edmonton and we were like, maybe $200 is just all Bitcoin's worth. Maybe this is just, it was $243. And we were like, maybe this is it. Maybe this is just what it's supposed to cost.
Yeah.
And because like you said, there was no one else to kind of talk to. I mean, at this point, there's Bitcoin Talk Forum and, you know, a few other chats, but the IRC chats is kind of where I got to lurk and read and hang out. But even still, I was too young, maybe, and immature to realize the economic and the sovereignty angle at that. Like at that point, it was just the investment angle, not the economic solution angle.
I don't know if you remember, but 2013, large part of the narrative was this is darknet money. This is the only reason that it's useful.
Yeah. Well, that was the mainstream push anyway. Yeah. So it was all the FUD.
And that was like, okay, well, if that's why it has value, then the arrest of Ross Ulbricht means that it's going to collapse, and it didn't. And that was like sort of like a catalyzing moment too. And
that surprised you that when Ross got arrested, it didn't.
Well, so that like OG or that email list. The OG guy came on and said, I might be selling at least half my position today because Ross Ulbricht was arrested. And I was like, maybe I should listen to him. But then, you know, it started going up and we had like one of the greatest bull runs of history, right? Yeah. Like that was 6 weeks where it went from $120 to $1,100.
Yeah.
And that was just absolutely insane. So, like the Bitcoin meetup just started getting random people, right?
Yeah.
It was one of those like crazy, crazy moments. Yeah. That whole year was just like a very, very strange thing to be living through, because it started the year at like $12 or something, right? And then like throughout the year, it did all this, like we basically had two huge pumps in that 1 year. And the expectation almost afterwards was like, oh, we're going to keep doing this like two pumps a year. And it was like, we had like two, 3 years
wrong
market, right? It was a very, very strange time. And it was an exciting time, right? It's a little bit similar to like the advent of email. It was like, you have an idea of how technology is going to evolve. Mm. But it's nothing like what you think it is.
Right.
And like very few people can really foresee how everything is going to play out. And, you know, in some ways, I suspect that's the case with AI right now. We have a particular conception of what the future is going to be like with it. But it's we're blinded, right, in a sense by sort of the novelty. And we don't truly understand it because there isn't sort of the deep analysis, I think, or you know, sort of running up against reality that's required to really get a better handle on that.
Yeah, you can kind of predict market forces, and you can probably see how history has played out with other tech. But this, I mean, with just like email, like email replaced letters, but then it turned into something completely brand new. Bitcoin replaced gold, and then and money, you know, sound money, and then also turns into something totally new. And an AI, you know, well,
looks like a like a replacement for like experts or something like that at this point. But it's going to turn into something completely different.
You would think so. I mean, that's if history rhymes at all, that's how it would be.
And you can see sort of hints of it, right? Like, there's like a whole phenomenon of like AI psychosis, which is not something that you would ever think about.
Totally.
But there are people that literally like started worshiping AI.
Yeah.
And there are people that fall in love with their AI. There are people that go crazy because the AI just tells them what they want. Like there are some weird fringe phenomenon that point to something about like this technology that we don't really fully grasp yet. And that's, you know, that was the case with, email. That was the case with Bitcoin. That was even the case with computers, right? Like when I first came in, I thought it was like this cool, fun thing to interact with.
And for your teacher, it was the babysitter for your Korean kid.
And, you know, I'm sure they sort of think linearly and think, okay, well, then I can babysit 50 other kids if I have 50 of these. Yeah. Instead of thinking like more new directions, which is what technology tends to do, it gets fit into things that you never would expect.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, the lesson here about Bitcoin and other things is that there's always like more to learn about it. And we don't really fully grasp it, at least at the beginning. And anyone that tells you this is exactly how it's going to be, they really have no clue.
No clue. Yeah.
Yeah. And I still remember like 95 or 96. I think Bill Gates had published the book about what the internet was going to be,
because like a dozen personal computers in the world or something like that.
That wasn't that one.
Okay. But that was his original thesis, wasn't it?
Well, it was something else, but there was, for me, like in the late 90s or the mid 90s and stuff, like the internet was like associated with Al Gore. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
But he was the one like that, like advocating for it. And, this is information superhighway. And that Bill Gates book was basically arguing that we're going to have like all these corporate intranets and like, you know, corporation-based things and not like this open thing. And that was it. Like, he was one of the, tech gurus or whatever that everyone was looking to for quotes and stuff. And it's just completely wrong.
Wow.
Right? Completely, completely, utterly wrong. So when I think about like Jamie Dimon, right? Like saying, Bitcoin is whatever, or Warren Buffett saying it's rat poison.
One of the financial gurus. Completely wrong.
Completely and utterly wrong. And this is the thing about technology. Like, very few people really understand it. So like when we're thinking about AI and you have these people saying, oh, we're going to get AGI and this guy, how it's going to, and Mark Andreessen saying this guy, how it's going to evolve or whatever. Do not believe any of them.
Yeah, I like that.
They have no idea what it's going to be doing. I don't think anyone does, because it's such a, like, it requires like a completely new direction that you're not going to be able to predict.
I think too, it's because people generally lose the first principle perspective of, like, to his credit, like Safe's book holds up 10 years later because it's completely first principle based. There's no vision casting. There's no guessing what humans are going to be doing. It's just, here are the physics of the world. Here's how Bitcoin answers those physics. Mm-hmm. And then you make your own thesis. And I think that's the best way to approach things. This is kind of how I arrived at I position Bitcoin as biblical money and the way that, like, I actually gave a presentation. The name's a little bit blasphemous, but it's called Jesus is a Bitcoiner. And it's describing how all these attributes that Bitcoiners, claim to have are attributes that Jesus taught, 2000 years ago. And how the relationship between Bitcoin as sound money and what the Bible teaches about, how humans should be acting and reacting is all first principle based.
Yeah. And it's one of those directions that no one expected. The morality of money is a huge thing now, but 2011.
Well, huge in Bitcoin circles, but I wouldn't say it's huge broadly. Like still pastors have a hard time. Like, I speak to even like elders at my church and to their credit, they're like listening, but they're not coming into it with, what do you mean our money's immoral? How do you mean that the fiat system is anti-biblical? Like, what are you talking about? And it's not a The Overton window is sure expanding, but it's not a mainstream.
Yeah, it's not, but it certainly speaks to people. Yeah. And that's something that I don't think anybody could have predicted in 2011. It was just like, oh, this is a more moral money? What? Right. What are you talking about? Like, but like that's kind of how it evolves in many ways.
When did that click for you?
The moral aspect?
Yeah.
I think like the more I studied fiat money, I think the like, and this is something that Bitcoin does, is that it makes you examine the system that exists.
Yeah.
And
certainly, every system that exists, not just the monetary system, the whole thing.
Yeah. But I think examining that and, you know, writing the Little Bitcoin book with Alex and my other co-authors for that book certainly lit something. And then by the time we did Thank God for Bitcoin and, you know, during COVID and meeting every week and talking about it, I think that really helped clarify things for me.
So you were researching for... So that's 2020, 2021.
Yeah. I mean, that was like, we had like a COVID Bible study. That's what turned into the book.
Was it with Bitcoiners or was it just...
It was with Bitcoiners. Cool. Well, the seven co-authors that I have, mm-hmm. they were part of that Bible
okay.
study.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what happened. But I think, the libertarian angle ended up pulling in a lot of the moral aspect of it.
Right.
Which I didn't really expect, but it turned out to really resonate with a lot of people. And that's something that, you know, like, I don't know if anyone could have predicted. And, you know, in many ways, like that's how technology goes.
Totally.
It's like, okay, how is this playing out? What?
Technology is like digital water, and water just flows down to where, like, to closer to the source, wherever. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really matter how, like, what your thoughts are, opinions are, the first principle's there. And I think technology is kind of the same way, where it gravitates. Technology will naturally enhance, I think, like, core and root humanity. And the reality is, like, especially if you read the Bible, but even if you don't believe the Bible, like, just the physics of the world is we don't do well in a captured in a captured state. You can take blood tests from prisoners and they're just like, they're just worse than free people. And that, I think that theory extrapolates across society. So you've got now, so you come over, you're this Christian, you kind of develop this libertarian angle, you find Bitcoin, and then you mash them all together. It sounds like in 2021 or 2020 with the Thank God for Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, that was more fortuitous than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like, I mean,
I don't think you were planning it.
And it was, and we started by studying the ethics of money production.
You did that when?
This was the thing that we were studying as a group, right?
Okay.
And you know, a lot of people have free time because of COVID, right? So, and we were meeting over Zoom or whatever. And we had like, you know, maybe 15 people come in and out of this Bible study that we were doing. And, you know, by the end of reading that book, which like makes the money and morality angle very, very explicit, not like what you do with the money, which is what people think of with the morality of money, but the system of money itself.
What's the book called? Who wrote it?
Your Guido Holzman. And it's called The Ethics of Money Production.
Cool.
And he wrote it before Bitcoin.
Right.
And and
does Bitcoin hold up in that?
Well, so the frustrating thing for us when we read the book was the ending. And
because there's no answer.
Yeah. Well, his answer was kind of like unrealistic, right? Because it said we need to get back on a gold standard. So we need to lock Congress and like, like get absolve the Fed or whatever. And it's like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, similar thing with Gary North's book, which we studied next, Honest Money. Very similar like ideas, right, about the immorality of money printing and the system and how it's intrinsically immoral. But again, he was kind of like, we need to go back to a gold standard. And that means like lobbying Congress or whatever. Yeah. It's like, that's not going to happen.
It seems so short-sighted, hey? Like taking this big, broad view of morality of money and then pigeonholing it down to Congress.
Well, but they didn't see any other way, right?
Sure.
So that was for them the only hope that they had of like uprooting the system. So look, that's how Thank God for Bitcoin came about was, okay, let's summarize what these guys are saying, right? Here's here are all the ways in which we can prove that the current system of money is evil, mm-hmm. right? It does this, these things to the incentives of people, organizations, even churches. But, you know, at the end, let's offer them hope in Bitcoin, right? Like this is a complete, like instead of doing this gold stuff, which is physical and has significant barriers because of that, or it's not a very good solution because of that. Let's show them like Bitcoin is much better. And yeah. and that connected like very, very well. And
with who? Bitcoiners?
Well, with a lot of people, particularly Christians. And we explicitly wanted to target Christians. And we knew we had something when one of my co-authors, Julia Turyansky, she's been a Bitcoiner for a long time. And she has a sister that she's been trying to orange pill for 6 years.
Wow.
And she gave her sort of like the manuscript. Hey, can you review it for us or whatever? She read it and she bought Bitcoin the next day.
Wow.
So we're like, okay. And, I think she's a Russian Orthodox or whatever, but she was like, okay, we got something here.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's convincing somebody that it took 6 years right. of trying to convince and nothing happened. And then she reads this book. So we knew we had something then. And, you know, that sort of argument, I think, has really resonated with a lot of Christians, because we just had like the Thank God for Bitcoin conference yesterday. A lot of people showing up. Yeah. And you find that a lot with people that have read the book, that understand the argument. Generally, Christians come in a little skeptical because they think, okay, technology, it's like, how are you going to even relate it? I still remember talking to Mike Peterson, and he's like, you know, when I saw the book, I was, I don't know if you're going to like.
He was into it though. Like he read it with an open mind.
Well, yeah, but he was into Bitcoin,
right.
And he's a missionary in El Salvador. Right.
Yeah.
And so he was like, I don't know if you can do this. And then he read the book. He's like, yeah, you got it.
Okay.
So I think a lot of Christians go in to the book thinking that it's going to be a certain way. It's going to be like very weird, brain twisting arguments in favor of Bitcoin, but really we're just talking about the corruption of the current system.
Yeah. And then adding Bitcoin as the solution with the, yeah. with the proof. And oh man, that's such good framing, because yeah. you don't need to do the mental gymnastics uh-huh. behind it. It's just, here's the first principle of what's wrong.
Yeah.
Here's the first principle of what a potential solution could be. Mm-hmm. And then here's something that fits all those principles.
and that's how honestly, a lot of Bitcoin Christians have gotten into Bitcoin. And, you know, it's like a big contrast to some Christians that are like advocating for altcoins or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that, but it's almost always like it's very hand wavy arguments.
Yeah.
Yeah, this could change the world and we can do so much for Christ. It's almost always just sort of like
pyramid scheme vibes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, you know, we made an argument in a particular way, which thankfully has resonated, and we're obviously very grateful for all the, you know, the traction that it's gotten or whatever. But
so what do you think the argument is? Like, you wrote a book for Christians that, you know, trying to bring them, like, you basically want to orange pill uh-huh. the Christians. What do you think the argument is for people who are Bitcoiners to show them the light? Mm-hmm. I believe I'm personally like an objective truth guy. I believe that there is just like an answer mm-hmm. to everything, and it's mm-hmm. objective. It's not uh-huh. like, oh, you believe this and I believe this and they're different, but they're both correct. Like, no. I just believe like, and I say all the time, like, look, if I'm wrong about Jesus, I want to know ASAP, because I'm kind of dedicating my life here. Uh-huh. And if I'm doing it the wrong way, then uh-huh. I want to know. I can't find, there's no good answer for it not to be Jesus as the, like, as the Messiah, mm-hmm. as the Savior, as God, as the Trinity, like all these things. How do you show, and I care so deep, I think, my goodness, like a white pilled Bitcoiner mm-hmm. is probably the most dangerous man on earth in a good way, because he's armed with sound money mm-hmm. and armed with like biblical knowledge and value mm-hmm. and just like sprinting towards a broader mission, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. How do you think white pilling the Christians, the Bitcoiners, so to speak, what is the argument there? If it's the morality of money brings the Christians in, what brings the Bitcoiners in?
Yeah, and we've been trying to figure out what's going on, right? Because this is a phenomenon that we don't really understand very well. But a lot of Bitcoiners come to Christ.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's almost happening like very organically. I have friends It took them like 6-7 years of study before they became a Christian, but they're doing it in a like a very specific, very deep way. Mm. They'll go look at all of the arguments. I had one friend that looked into Arianism for a whole year.
Wow.
Right?
Like, wow.
That's a 4th century heresy.
Yeah.
And he's looking into it for a whole year.
Yeah.
Like, that's not normal.
Totally.
Right? Like, generally, if you hear like Christian testimony, like very rarely will I, in fact, I've never heard of any Christian saying, you know what? And I got held up by the Arian heresy for a whole year.
That's true.
See, that's not something that anyone does. But it's a phenomenon that I've seen a lot, where like a lot of Bitcoiners start taking Christ seriously, right? And it's usually like slow and very methodical. Yeah. And very rational. And, you know, maybe there is like a miracle in there or whatever. I mean, in a sense, every salvation is a miracle, but it's a very like interesting phenomenon. And I, and every time I tell my Christian friends this, they're always surprised. I'm like, you know, like when people get into Bitcoin, they turn to Christ. They're like,
yeah,
what?
How's that happen? For sure.
What's going on? But I've seen it happen so often, and I'm still at a loss to explain it exactly. The best explanation that I've come up with is that Bitcoin is, in a sense, like a little taste of truth. It's a little bit bitter because you've been lied to the entire time, but it's very satisfying. Right.
Right.
There's something about it. It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I get it now. I understand how the monetary system works. And the tendency of Bitcoiners is that after they've done that, they tend to want more of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've definitely seen this in the Bitcoin community where they'll completely change their diet or exercise routine or, you know, start homeschooling, for example. A lot of like atheist Bitcoiners with kids like homeschool their kids.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's like, what's going on? Like,
yeah.
That's a little strange.
Why do you think that's strange? Just quick side note. Why would the atheist side of that be the weird part?
Well, because homeschooling is like known to be a very Christian thing, right? Right. So there's a lot of those little things where, you know, they start, you know, getting into, you know, like learning about microplastics, for example.
Right. Right? Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Just like,
yeah, that was not on my bingo card.
Yeah, but that's like completely normal, right?
Yeah.
Where's my food come from?
Yeah.
Like I went to raw milk now, right?
Yeah.
Like just, right. And they start learning, and again, slightly bitter pill to swallow, but very satisfying once again, it's like, okay, I have a better understanding of the world. And you get all these little T-truth pills. And then at the end, you get it, you start thinking about the bigger T-truth, mm, about the meaning of life. What's it all for? Like, how do I, you know, and it may come from a very practical standpoint. It's like, I have these kids. How do I teach them this stuff? What reason am I giving them to have this morality that I think is right, that I believe is right, but I don't have a very good reason for? And then they end up swallowing the big T truth, which goes down very bitter because you have to confess that you're a sinner. Mm. You have to admit that you're a very bad person. At the end of it, say, okay, but I surrender my life to Christ. And like a lot of them have crossed it, right? And then they find out that it is very satisfying, that, and they are very deeply engaged with Christ in a way that, like, I don't know, I don't want to denigrate any sort of like conversion experience or whatever, but I mean, you've seen, you know, you remember like the Billy Graham crusade things,
yeah, yeah,
right? Like, if Christ is calling you, yeah, come down right now. And you know what, like, for me, that's like, I'm not questioning the legitimacy of that, but it is a little bit more shallower, maybe.
Yeah.
Little bit more emotional and less deeply ingrained into like your system of values and stuff. And I don't see Bitcoiners doing that, right? Mm-hmm. Like where they're in a Billy Graham crusade and they like come down because, you know, they're sort of swept up in it. I don't think that's the character of Bitcoiners. It's much more like deep study.
Low time, you know, preference.
Yeah. It's like, and maybe they start praying, you know, they look into stuff like Shroud of Turin, and you know, they go down interesting rabbit holes.
Yeah, the logic of of God there. I find that to be the most fascinating side of things. Is my relationship with God over the last 5 years has been, I'd say, more like logic based than emotional. I was even on a podcast talking about this like 3 or 4 years ago, like how the emotional side, the you know, I pray, but it's more out of a like open my eyes to the truth type of prayer.
Yeah.
And that lot, the Shroud of Turin, the, you know, even like even evidence for the flood and, and like reading the Bible as a history document compared to this like fairy tale of morals is a completely different mindset that even I didn't grow up in the church, but I went to church starting when I was about like 12 or 13 or so. And I wouldn't say I learned the Bible as like a truth document.
Yeah.
You know, maybe as like, this is the truth, but like, you know, you know, we're gonna tiptoe around the stuff that science contradicts with or whatever.
And that's something that a lot of Bitcoiners have is some skepticism of what they've been told. So like, you know, you, especially after COVID, right? Like where all these experts, quote unquote, like told people, you have to keep 6 feet away, but if it's in a you know, Black Lives Matter rally,
No fine, problem. Right? Like,
and it didn't make it.
The best one for me was the arrows in the grocery store, man. Like, if you only went one way down a soup aisle, somehow you were going to be safer than if you went against the arrow. And it's just like, well, the mental gymnastics, I think it was a test. I think it was, how brainwashed is the mass population that we can control people in this way?
And I think a lot of people kind of saw through that and they stopped trusting the experts,
the
scientists or what they were told. So they were much more open to the possibility of the Bible being a truth document.
Right. Maybe the history docs were also doctored or were also, you know, experts.
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of like rational arguments that Christians make that maybe they weren't exposed to until they started like actually looking into it. And like, honestly, stuff like Shroud of Turin, like like a lot of Christians, I think, oh, that's not that important, or it's only for nerds or whatever. But those things actually kind of matter.
So the Shroud of Turin. So I was previously like, maybe not super convinced that was Jesus, but then I maybe shifted my perspective on this Easter, actually noting all the different the head trauma on that's evidenced on the Shroud of Turin, which looks like how someone would have a crown of thorns on their head.
Yeah, and it's not the crown of thorns that you see in paintings, but it's like a real helmet.
A helmet, right? This year was the first year that I experienced that. Those big, what do you call them? The Bethlehem thorns and like the helmet of, because a crown, of course, is not just a little wreath. It's like a proper helmet.
Yeah.
And seeing that. And so this was the first year that I kind of, and my son and I, my 9-year-old, we were talking about this and he was blown away. He was like, what do you mean this is the cloth they buried Jesus in? And I was like, well, like, I don't know. And I used to think it wasn't the case, but here it is. And again, you know, this is just this year. I've been a Christian for 20 years. I've been a Bitcoiner for, you know, 12. And still I'm changing my mind on certain things. And I love that about Bitcoiners is that we're in pursuit of truth.
You go where the evidence leads you. And I think that's like actually a very human thing.
I think also that if you're humble enough to have new evidence change your mind.
Yeah. That's a humility that I think Bitcoiners got through Bitcoin, right? Because you're not living in fantasy like altcoiners where they're like, what truth is whatever we want it to be.
And roll back the chain if we don't like it. Talk to the foundation.
So there's definitely an aspect of that I think that causes a lot of Bitcoiners to come to Christ is that idea that there is an objective truth and that there very well might be things that the conventional narrative misses because they've seen it just so often in all those other areas with truth. The truth pills is okay. Yeah, maybe cholesterol isn't the be all end all of your health. Maybe sugar is kind of bad for you. Maybe seed oils are bad for you. Maybe, you know, like cardio isn't great exercise. Maybe you should strength train. Maybe you should, you know, maybe
rush red meat.
Yeah. Maybe like self-defense isn't like, you know, maybe guns aren't evil, right? Like stuff like that. There's a lot of little things that, you know, if you go down these rabbit holes, you get used to a certain pattern of deception that you've seen. And you know, Christianity being sort of like the big one where a lot of people have been deceived, right? By the conventional narrative that, oh, this is just like a story and it's not legit or whatever. And they start questioning and they come to a place where they do accept it. Might take them a long time, but yeah. I actually don't mind that. I think that's great. It's very honest. It's very humble, and it's going through it in a systematic way, not like sort of like a wishy-washy way.
Yeah, yeah, big dope, big time.
Like, which I associate with like Jordan Peterson, right?
Yeah. Well, he's funny because I think he logically gets it, but just refuses to submit, I think.
And you get the sense of him with Bitcoin too.
Totally, right?
There's like a...
I've got strong opinions, but not positions.
Yeah, and it's... he just can't make that intellectual leap because he's sort of still captured by the fiat system, which I think we as Bitcoiners recognize about a lot of people, yeah. Where they see the logic, but they can't justify doing it because of the position that they have in the fiat world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough thing, I think, for most of society to try to swallow is, I think, objectivity, because mm-hmm. we do live in a world that, you know, from what we're being told, is constantly expanding and changing and based on random chance. And mm-hmm. like the narrative is designed to keep us guessing and feel small, right? Mm-hmm. You live in this little pebble in some vast universe, then you're just an accident and, you know, no one created you. But you have morality, but you can't really answer why. And it started from nothing. And, you know, you're just designed and taught to feel small. And like, very uninspiring to be a little clog in an accidental wheel is a very uninspired thing. But you read the Bible and you hear that, like, oh, you were created for a purpose and there's a plan and like you're gonna fulfill that plan, but you also have freedom and like all this crazy stuff that looks like it's at tension, but then there's an answer through deity and stuff that I originally thought was a contradiction in the Bible actually is a pursuit of truth in the Bible. And mm-hmm. it's a really interesting mindset.
And it gives you a very different perspective of what humanity is supposed to be.
Good take.
I don't think a lot of people, or they try to create their own meaning. And like, and this is like an issue I guess I have with like postmodern art. It's almost always like a message of nihilism. Mm. Nothing means anything.
Yeah. Right?
Like the ending of Game of Thrones. Nothing means anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, that's about like the most nihilistic series ever. It's this idea that you make your own meaning and nothing means anything anyway. But with Christianity, there is something, and you can kind of feel it, right? When you have kids or whatever, there is a deep sense of meaning in those children, and there's like a connection that you have, and it's like, what is it? Just like a flood of emotion? Is it just random particles, right? Like.
Accidental neurons.
Yeah. or does it actually mean something? And it gives voice to the intuitions that you have deep inside, right? The law written on our hearts. And I think that's ultimately where a lot of people end up. Hopefully, there's more of that, but yeah, it's a dark world, man. I kind of get like the progressive psychosis, right? Like a lot of them are just deeply depressed, like just, and they're on a lot of medications and things like that because nothing has meaning, right? Yeah. And they try to fight for meaning. They try to make it, and they twist their brains to say, okay, well, if we get this pass, or if we get quote unquote freedom for these people, if I'm finding like that, then that gives my life meaning. But yeah, it's not that satisfactory. And you could see it in their eyes. You can feel it in their voice when they're speaking. It's the same sort of like voice that you hear from like old like videos of the USSR or whatever. It's
right.
Like people that are saying something with their mouth but feeling something very different in their heart. Yeah,
yeah, the mass. I mean, it's division. It's like, I don't know how you feel about even democracy as a whole, but even. Like this idea that en masse humans, corrupt humans can, first of all, be in charge of other humans, but then second of all, make the right decision for the long term based off of, at this point, we know to be lies. It's, what do you think, what is a biblical, democratic, political leadership system? Like you read the Bible, pretty clear, God God didn't design us to be ruled by a man. Like, he didn't want, you know, the book of Judges is a terrible book. It looks like it's like just a downward spiral, but that was the original intent. And then the humans are like, we need a king. And God's like, no, that's not going to be good. And then the demon's like, no, give us a king. And then King Saul comes in and he's good. And then more spiral, more problems and more issues. What does a good system look like for?
Yeah. And I've thought about this a lot, like the difference between kings and judges. You know, the tendency is for centralization. And the warning, I think, God gives through Samuel to the Israelites in Samuel is very instructive, because his warnings are all about what's going to happen to you. Right. It's okay. The king's going to take your sons and put them into battle. Right. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose your sons. The biggest inheritance that you have, right, yeah, is your progeny. He's going to take your lands. Right. He's going to tax you. He's going to take away the fruits of your labor. In a sense, God is warning, okay, you put a person in charge, there's a huge tax to be paid. Mm-hmm. Right. The freedom that you have when it's God directing you is very different than the sort of like rent seeking and taxes that come through a human authority. And this is why, you know, he was saying like, I am your king. And if you look at Judges, right, versus the era of Judges versus the Judges of the era of Kings, what's very striking to me when I read that is you look at who becomes a judge, right? Deborah, Samson, you know, like all these people that might not necessarily have like the right lineage, right? But they end up judging, right? Like Deborah's like the one that's like most shocking to me. She's a woman, mm-hmm, right? She's older and she does things like under a tree, right? And God's able to tell people what they need to do through her. Whereas, you know, the era of kings, it's you have to have the exact right lineage. You're expected to be a certain way. There's a very strict qualification, and it's based on man's standards rather than God's standards, right, which are, you know, like Gideon was like the last son of like an unimportant tribe or whatever. And he ends up doing all this stuff, and he judges Israel for however many years. The thing that people felt incredibly uncomfortable with was that there wasn't a succession plan. It wasn't clear what was going to happen. And oftentimes there would be consequences for their sin. They whenever they went and worshiped foreign gods, God would deliver them into the hands of a foreign enemy, right? And they didn't like that. They wanted more certainty going forward. And God was saying, well, you know, worship me. And you'll be fine. But instead, they're like, well, we want the option of doing this and whatever. And even the narrative of the two eras is very different, because you read Judges and it's like the people of Israel were doing this. Mm. The people of Israel were doing this. The people of Israel were doing this. And then you get into the era of the kings and it's like, this king was bad. Right. This king was good. Good. This king was bad. This king was good. So in a sense, it was from a Girardian sense, right? And I don't know if you're a fan. Okay, all right. So Rene Girard has this whole theory. He's a Christian, and he came by it very interestingly. He analyzed like all these myths and stuff like that. And his contention was that there's mimetic rivalry, right? Like the people that fight the most are the ones that are most alike and don't realize it.
Oh, interesting.
Right. And then there's the resolution of that mimetic rivalry when you have something scarce like status, where there needs to be a resolution because you get sort of tit for tat, right? And they keep attacking each other and it's an escalating violence, but it needs a resolution. And the resolution that has always been found throughout history is some scapegoat, some sacrifice. And it has to be somebody innocent that both sides can say it was their fault. And then that causes peace again. And then the mimetic rivalry happens again. And then you need another scapegoat. And it's and his contention is that if you look at all myths and stuff like that, that mechanism is hidden a little bit, but you can see hints of it. So the classical example is the one of Oedipus, right? Where there's like and if you read the myth carefully, there's like a plague. Oedipus is a king. There's like a plague. What's going on? How is this happening? And he discovers that he actually married his mom, right?
Okay.
Right.
Whoops.
The Oedipus complex, right?
Yeah.
And this whole other thing, and he ends up dying, and he's sort of like the scapegoat sacrifice that makes it all things new again. And it's a very deep sort of like analysis of culture and things like that. But I brought up. I'm trying to remember why I brought it up about Girardian mimetic. So from a biblical sense, right? Like going back to the era of kings, the king is sort of that sacrifice, right? Mm-hmm. This allows the rest of the Israelites to say,
pass blame.
It's this guy's fault that we did. It's a way to.
It can't be God's fault, obviously.
Yeah. And they don't want to be my
fault. Yeah.
Because. All through Judges, we didn't worship. So kings in a way, and this is Gerard's argument too, is that oftentimes kings are that sacrifice, right?
Wow.
Oedipus and stuff. So if you analyze it from that perspective, it totally makes sense because we don't want to be responsible for our sin. And then the reason why Gerard became a Christian was because he recognized that Jesus was the ultimate scapegoat and innocent king, right? That was a sacrifice for everybody else.
Right.
But it was told from the perspective, that story was told from his perspective as a good thing rather than blaming like Oedipus, right? The innocent one. Every other myth in all other cultures always blames that and justifies it.
Yeah.
Whereas this is actually an innocent person and is
and
not making it
historically historically innocent, which is crazy.
Yeah. And the more you sort of like look at or read Gerard and things like that, the more of that like you see, right? Where very similar rivalries like actually end up causing war. It causes conflict and things like that. So there was an interesting article I read the other day about Iran and sort of like the social things that they're going through. A lot of people would be surprised to know that they're very similar to the US. Like, so they're having very low birth rates. A lot of their young people are unemployed. Like their women are more feminist than you would think and stuff like that. There's a lot of parallels there. And it's that mimetic rivalry that actually ends up creating the people that you go war with, even though you pretend that they're as different from you as possible,
right?
They're actually very similar. Yeah. And that's that's where the conflict comes from. And Christianity, his conclusion was that Christianity is the only way out of this mimetic rivalry cycle.
It is kind of like I think that the sacrifice and the cross is the single greatest differentiator from literally every religion to Christianity. Every other religion says work hard and you'll get it. For the most part, it's all by your works. And then Christianity is the only one that says you can't work hard enough. So you better, don't worry. I got you.
Yeah.
And I think that humility that Christ displayed is probably the single greatest differentiator. And again, like just objectively speaking, is the main answer there,
and this is why Gerard became a Christian. He recognized that this is a very different story than every other one.
Interesting,
and it's the one that made civilization possible, Western civilization possible, because after that you couldn't do the sacrifice. Although, like as we get more pagan, you're starting to see more of it.
Yeah.
Which is one of the evidences of that I like to point out is look at the last 10 or so losing VP candidates.
Okay.
What has happened to them? All right, so let's go back one. So Kamala Harris was her VP candidate was Tim Walz.
Okay,
butt of every joke, right? Like the one that's like blamed essentially for their loss, right?
Right.
Right. By the Democrats. Okay. The one before that, who was Trump's VP candidate? Mike Pence. completely isolated from the Republican Party. He's basically a non-entity at this point. But a lot of MAGA thinks he's the ultimate betrayer or whatever, the one that's getting the blame. I think Tim Kaine has done okay, right? That's the one that Hillary Clinton had.
Okay.
But the one before that, 2012, Mitt Romney's VP candidate was Paul Ryan. Was Speaker of the House right afterwards, like
nothing.
Got the blame for everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He goes away. 2008, who was the VP candidate for John McCain? Sarah Palin. Butt of every joke. Again, like getting the blame for what it was. 2004, this was John Edwards, right? Completely isolated from the Democrat Party, right? He becomes like...
Why do you think this is? Why do you think...
This is, again, the mimetic, the scapegoat mechanism, right? Okay. And the thing about it, the scapegoat is that it has to be close to power, but not exactly.
Right.
That's exactly what a VP candidate...
The king is not God, but he's there. And the VP is not the candidate, but they're right there. They were advising. They were the two IC.
But they didn't actually, right? Like they're the ones that are...
Yeah, the easy...
Yeah. And the one before that, Joe Lieberman, right? Again, 8 years later, he's speaking at the Republican convention.
Yeah.
Like the pattern is definitely there as we get more pagan, because it was Christianity that took out the scapegoat mechanism of requiring the innocent blood be shed to sort of like get rid of the violence and rivalry. And instead it required like a more realistic view of things. And that's what allowed civilization to build and stop sort of that mimetic violence that occurs in every other society.
Yeah, I've never heard that take before. I like that a lot. And I think it sounds like it's probably hard-coded into us
it's a much deeper thing that I'm presenting. Just like one aspect of it, but it's one of those rabbit holes that a lot of Bitcoiners go down. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah,
yeah. Rene Girard and his thinking, and yeah, because and he comes from a very Girard was a professor at Stanford, and he was a big influence on Peter Thiel, for example, and one of the reasons why he professes himself to be Christian or whatever was because of Girard. And all desire is mimetic desire, and Peter Thiel specifically cited Girard as a reason why he invested in Facebook.
Interesting.
Because it's all about mimetic rivalry. It's people that are very similar that are incentivized to one up each other in the status game on Facebook. That's very he was like, yeah, this is going to addict them.
Well, he was right.
He was exactly right. His analysis on that was absolutely spot on. But yeah, that's another whole rabbit hole you can go down. I've had a podcast on that, on my YouTube channel for a bunch of reasons. But yeah, this is just one aspect of many things that we could talk about.
That's crazy, man. Yeah, no, I like that. I'll have to read some of that. I'm not super familiar. I haven't gone down this like theological rabbit hole too much. Like obviously I have with the Bible and then Bitcoin, and I'm well-versed on both, but I'm not well-versed on like the writings that are kind of adjacent to that. And so I need
Gerard has been sort of on 4chan and things like that starting like 15 years ago. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of that thought, which... The more you study it, the more sense it makes and things like that. There's a popular book, Introduction to Girard, basically Wanting. Girard can be a little dense to read and a little harder. But once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, yeah, that's mimetic rivalry. Or that's
well, I mean, I'm sold on mimetic. I think that makes sense. Yeah. What do you think in kind of, I want to wrap here right away. We can get to the conference. But what would you say is the biggest misconception for Bitcoiners that don't know Jesus? Like they're there. Maybe they've heard it. Maybe they've turned away. Why? How do you think that happens? What's the other side of the argument?
I think a lot of them. Well, I'll tell you what it's not. I don't think they think the morality is a problem. In fact, that's what draws a lot of them in the first place. Is that these people have good morals? What's going on? Whereas like more the altcoiners and stuff, they want to do what they want to do. They want liberality or whatever, and they'll brain twist their way into believing what'll get them that. The thing that stops them is usually related to, you know, science or something like that, mm-hmm. or what they perceive to be science. But you know, they're a little skeptical of science. So it's like, okay, what part of it do you believe? So, you know, some of it is metaphysical, right? Like philosophical. They're into other things, which explain certain things. So,
okay.
Usually some other sort of conspiracy type thing that prevents them. But yeah,
that's the problem with being a conspiracy theorist. Hey, is if it's, especially if it's rooted in other people, this camp game, man, of just labels and pushing people into pigeonholed beliefs. Like, I believe one thing that this guy believes, and because he believes something else, I automatically believe it. Such a dangerous proof of stake game, really.
But the thing that sort of repulses them from that is that, okay, this like cringy atheist guy also believes this.
Right, totally.
So in a way, it works for
that's a good point.
Both ways a little bit. But yeah, I think a lot of Bitcoiners are a lot closer, to Christ than you would think.
So then once a Bitcoiner meets Christ, how do you think, because there are some things that I wrestle, like Romans 13 is like the classic libertarian knife in the side. You know, how does a Bitcoiner respond? You know, the debt, like the whole, look at what Saylor's building and like, you know, it's a complete debt-based system on top of Bitcoin. I think you and I would agree that debt probably isn't a moral, like debt is a moral issue and it looks like debt is probably immoral based on the Bible. How do you rectify all of this?
Well, I mean, they're not necessarily Saylor supporters, right? Especially if you're Bitcoin,
right?
In Bitcoin. So that's, I don't think as big a difficulty as...
But just debt in general, like I would say it's quite logical to take out a low interest loan and buy Bitcoin. That makes a lot of sense.
That's a rational move. Yeah. From a financial standpoint, if your goal is financial wealth, but if that were your thing, then you would get into altcoins and try to promote your altcoin and do that. Right. So yeah, I think for most people that are in Bitcoin, that isn't, contrary to popular opinion, that isn't their primary thing. Their primary thing, you know, oftentimes they can't even articulate it, is something truthful, right? Like something that moral. isn't dishonest, right? Like they want something honest, something good. And that's what they're seeking. And I think the biggest barrier for almost all of them is what is the biggest barrier for any non-Christian. It is coming to terms with your own sin. It's recognizing that I am a sinner, right? Like, and that is a very, and it's
you're
hard,
not as good as you think you are.
Yeah, and it's hard for, to get into sort of like that non-Christian mindset and understand or empathize with that, because it is devastating, right? To recognize you're a bad person.
Right.
And you need Christ. You need redemption. That everything that you think you've done that's good is nothing. It's worth nothing. And it's only by the grace of God that you can be saved, that you can't do something that like this debt, spiritual debt is so big that you need God to rectify it for you. It's very humbling. It's very difficult, and it has been from the beginning the biggest barrier and the reason why people jump through mental hoops to justify themselves on, and that's at a deep level why people refuse. But at a certain point, if you're confronted with that in an honest way, you know, you have a choice. And yeah, I think that's the biggest barrier.
Yeah, humility. Yeah. And what do we say? Stay humble, stack sats. Jimmy, this has been great, man. Thank you so much for coming on. We covered, it's always great, man. I love talking to Bitcoiners about truth and the Bible and God. And yeah, it's so cool. So I really appreciate anything. You know, usually I like to kind of ask, like, what's something that you've maybe been exploring or have changed your perspective on in the last. So in closing, maybe hit us with the most recent thing that your mindset has shifted on.
My mindset has shifted on, I guess, the nature of fatherhood. So I've been homeschooling a couple of my kids.
Okay. How many kids do you have?
I have six.
Okay, but nice.
I'm doing it for two of my kids. And
the oldest or the youngest?
No, they're in the middle.
Okay.
The thing that I've recognized is that most of education is not about knowledge. Hmm. Right. And that's sort of the lie that we tell ourselves. If you just get experts in, then that's enough.
Right.
The thing that kids are missing, that learners are missing almost all of the time, is the will to do it.
Okay.
Right.
Discipline.
And it's your job as a father to give them some of the willpower that you have, because you've developed it over a long period of time. And children are notoriously bad at willpower. And they're almost always very capable of learning whatever it is you put in front of them, especially if it's age appropriate. The hard part for them is sitting there and doing it. Mm. And that's your job as a father. It isn't to say, okay, like here's something that's going to blow your mind. I'm going to blow your mind every day with knowledge. That's not it. That's actually like very far from your role as a father. Your role as a father is to give discipline, is to help them develop their own will, right? To be able to do these things. And that's given me a lot of perspective on what the role of God as father is.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah.
Because in a sense, like we're all undisciplined in so many different ways. And, you know, we call God father because that's what he's providing for us. Hmm. We don't call God mother, right? Who's like unconditionally loving you and stuff like that. Although, you know, modern Christianity, that tends to be the direction that we go in. We call him father because that discipline, that, you know, development of your character is the role of the father. And it is the role that you have to take seriously as a father. So yeah, that's something.
Man, that's one of the most insightful things that I've probably heard on this on the short time of this show. So thank you. As a father of four and one more coming in the summer, also homeschooling. Uh-huh. But that's honestly falls more on my wife than it does on me. But
That's the thing. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Because the rest of your family also depends on you for that. Sure. And that's your role as a father is you have to give some of that willpower that you've stored up into all of those things, because it's not just about knowledge. That's actually like very far away from they can do that themselves. They're actually very well equipped to do that.
Yeah.
It's your role in developing their character. That's biblical. Yeah,
man. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for this. I think that's a good place to wrap. So thanks, Jimmy.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for watching The Conversation with Jimmy. For those of you that don't know, my name is Adam O'Brien. I'm the founder and CEO of Bitcoin Well. Bitcoin Well is on a mission to enable independence. And we do that by making it easy to buy and sell Bitcoin directly with your personal Bitcoin wallet. If that interests you, you can go to bitcoinwell.com. But above that, I am a follower of Jesus. I'm a husband to my beautiful wife, and she's given me four and almost five amazing kids. If any of that interests you as I navigate what my life should look like, how we pursue objective truth, what that means, subscribe. Let me know what you think in the comments down below. Thanks so much for watching and sticking out to the end, and I'll catch you next